Hello and welcome to the Chengdu Gaming Federation podcast. My name is Charlie and I'm joined once again by a guest named Ryan, who's a local independent game developer just on the cusp of releasing his new game. Welcome.
Hello, I'm excited to be here and talk about my new game, Carrier Commander.
Carrier Commander, it's very exciting to have you on the podcast and to talk about this with you because in a recent podcast, we talked about what's going on in the Chinese gaming industry, and it's mostly bad news, especially for independent game developers. There are a lot of restrictions and difficulties about publishing games, releasing games, monetizing games in China, so it's not a lot of independent game development activity inside China at the moment, and it seems that most people who are pursuing independent games are either marketing those games abroad outside of China or just doing it as a side project.
Yeah, you know, I got started in the gaming industry by working in China, but working on this game, I never even considered China as like a target market, partially because it's just impossible to break into without having like some local Chinese support.
Literally impossible. You cannot publish a game legally in China without working with a Chinese publishing partner.
It's really difficult, but China's not a terrible place to work on your indie game just because it's pretty cheap to live here.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, what I did was I just lived here. Cost of living's low. I live in a nice city, Chengdu. And I've been working on this game for 2 years. And over the course of that 2 years, I worked 2,000 hours on the game. So if you do a little math, that's 50, 40-hour weeks. So basically,
it's almost a year.
Yeah, so I spent a full-time year developing this game and not getting paid for it. And I think it really helps to live in Asia to do that. There's a lot of people that do that developing software and games that move. Usually they move to Thailand.
Sure.
Because it's a little nicer, but I did it mostly in China.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly a lot of time, but I think of that time invested not just in the development of this one game, which, you know, who knows what'll happen with this game. Hopefully it goes well, obviously, but in spending that time developing yourself, developing your skills. Now you've built a foundation. You can use that foundation and those skills and that knowledge to develop other games or do other things.
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, you know, what got me started on this particular game was I was reading a lot of kind of blogs about how to get started in indie development. And there was one school of thought that you just hear over and over again, and it's build 1,000 prototypes, build more and more prototypes, just build 100 games, and then finally you'll find your game. And I'd say that's the predominant school of thought for people getting started in indie development. But I found one blog that said the exact opposite. It said, make your first dollar. And if you think about it, just $1, right? But to get that first dollar, you have to do the entire process from start to publishing to make that first dollar. So I kind of took on that as a challenge just to learn the whole process of what it is to make a game. And man, I could tell you, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, sure is.
That's so much work.
It's interesting to hear you describe your approach as the opposite of sort of the conventional advice which independent game developers get. And I've seen some of those blogs. I think one of them might be like Game a Week or something like that. Some kind of program where a lot of indie developers are making a new prototype every week. And I think the Downwell was one of the games which came out of that philosophy.
That's a great game, but you kind of get the impression he must have made that in just a very short time.
Yeah, it was one of those game like Game a Week type prototypes, which found some success and was developed into a game and then a big hit game. But it does make sense to try a lot of things and see what works. But I mean, when you're at the basic level, I think it's difficult to make those prototypes. I mean, maybe you can think of sort of an attractive idea. You can go through the ideation process, but to actually build something really requires a lot of multidisciplinary ability.
Right. So one thing I'm hoping to do with this podcast is to kind of use my experience and what I learned developing Carrier Commander and just present it for anyone else who is an aspiring indie dev who maybe wants to see what the whole process looks like.
Yeah. So let's start at the beginning. How did you get the idea to do this? I mean, you were joined on a previous, actually two episodes, I think, where we talked about game development in China. And you talked about how you got into the game industry here in China. For anyone listening to this, you can check out that previous podcast with Ryan. But what gave you the idea that you wanted to make your own game? And how did you get started on the first steps to make Carrier Commander?
So I was reading all those blogs, like we just talked about. And I was simultaneously working at a Chinese game company. And they had been developing a game that basically looks exactly like Clash Royale, except in landscape mode instead of portrait. And what's funny was they had been working on it for years before Supercell ever came out with Clash Royale.
That is funny.
So Clash Royale came out, and they were my company was just getting ready to publish their game, and they said, well, fuck, what are we going to do? Because obviously we can't compete with the number one game company in the whole world that just made the same game. So they asked me for some ideas, and I built a little prototype of kind of the same kind of game mechanics, but just a little bit different. It was naval strategy instead of fantasy. It had this added mechanic of drawing the paths on the screen. And if you're familiar with Clash Royale, you know the characters just kind of progress on their own.
Autopilot.
Yeah, autopilot. So I presented this as a prototype, and they kind of looked at it and they said, no, we just want to do something that's like more exactly like Clash Royale. I said, all right, well, you do that. And I ended up quitting that company. But this prototype that I built, for some reason, it just stuck with me. It was like, this is a game that I want to build.
Yeah.
And it's actually funny how I found that idea for that game. I wanted to talk about the subreddit, Game Ideas. You ever been there?
Yeah, I have.
I spent like a week just going through every single Game Ideas post for like the past couple years, originally to help my company. And I found one, and the guy's name is Sean, and he's one of my beta testers now. And it was just his idea. He said, what about a game where there's two aircraft carriers and you take turns drawing like the flight path of the airplanes to attack the other aircraft carrier?
Hmm.
And that's the game.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Was this idea one which you solicited on the website, or did you find it browsing other posts?
No, I just found it looking through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of game ideas.
It reminds me a little bit of that really old iPhone game. I think it was called Flight Control. Did you ever play that?
Yeah, was it called Flight Control?
I might be mistaken on the name, but it was a game where you're landing aircraft by drawing the flight path.
It's very that was a game where you were trying to make the planes not hit each other.
Exactly.
And this is like the reverse of that.
I see.
This is like an offensive flight control where you're trying to attack the other airport.
I think around 2010, sort of or 2011, the very early days of the iOS App Store, Flight Control, if I'm remembering the name correctly, it was a very popular game at the time. And that drawing the flight path was a very novel mechanic, which was very popular in that game.
Yeah, because at the time, I mean, drawing a path was something we hadn't seen in video games before.
Exactly.
With the advent of touchscreen, it became possible. And nowadays, there's still not a ton of games where you're drawing the path, are there?
No, there are not a lot. There are very few, actually. Have you ever heard of a game called The Ember Conflict?
No.
This is an independent game which was developed by a friend of mine, really cool guy named Pin, who's an independent developer, ethnically Chinese American, who has lived and worked in Beijing for about a decade, I think. He quit his job working in a Chinese game company and decided to pursue his own independent game project. Unfortunately, it didn't work out very well. He received investment and built a company and had people working there.
Wow.
It was an online competitive strategy game. It was like a real-time strategy game where you're drawing the path of the units.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
yeah, really, it sounds cool. A lot like my game in some ways.
It does. It was made for tablets, so I don't know if it ever even ran on phones, actually. It was around the time that Vainglory was getting a lot of hype, so there was a lot of discussion around the MOBA, multiplayer online battle arena game genre on touchscreen devices, and so he was kind of trying to capitalize on that popularity. But it turns out that MOBA never really blew up on touchscreen devices at all. So unfortunately, it didn't work out and he had to shut the whole thing down, which was very sad. But that is how it goes in independent game development. It's really cutthroat, really difficult, very competitive. But anyway, he pursued a company which was built around the idea of this one game.
That's pretty cool. And, you know, growing up, RTS games were my favorite games, and that genre has just died out.
Totally.
And I always thought with tablets that would be the perfect place to play like StarCraft or games like that.
Yeah, you would think. But, you know, mouse really does have the precision control, which is necessary for that type of game. When you move it over to tablet, it's really a different thing, or a phone. A lot of game developers have attempted to do that, and no one has really failed to even come close to something like StarCraft.
Yeah, that's true. I think really all that's left of RTS is it just kind of morphed into tower defense.
Right.
And that whole genre.
Or just like League of Legends, you know, that's like the new real-time strategy. But in any case, so Carrier Commander, you got the idea on Reddit. And then what were the next steps? You tried to figure out a game development platform, like an SDK or something?
So step one was, and that's a good point, what tool? I was using GameMaker. Different people can use different tools. GameMaker was built for people who want to build 2D games. GameMaker can deploy to a number of platforms, Android, iOS, Windows, macOS. And now they just added Switch, which I'm really excited about.
That is exciting.
So I chose GameMaker mostly because of the deployability. And the first thing I did, first step, was to build that prototype. So I built the prototype and I submitted it to the company and they rejected it or whatever. So then the real first step is a game design document.
Right.
So I sat down and I looked at some templates and I looked at some game design documents for other games that I liked. And I just spent a lot of time figuring out all of the details because, you know, most of game design is in planning. If you do all the planning first, your development process is so much easier. And
sure, because when you complete construction of the game design document, you're answering all the difficult questions, which otherwise you would encounter in the middle of production. So you're in the middle of making a game and you encounter some unforeseen problem and it can really sideline you and mess you up. And the game design document is to prevent that situation from happening by answering all those questions up front.
Yeah, and you know, in some ways, the game design document, it kind of flies in the face of what a lot of software developers are doing with Agile, which is build the minimum viable product and then build out from there.
Yeah, true.
And game design document is kind of more of a waterfall approach, just from start to finish, what does the finished product look like? But I think for games, that's what works. Or that's what works for me.
What did your document look like? How many pages was it? What did it include? Is there anything unusual about it that people could learn from?
Yeah, let me think about it. So it was probably about 5 to 10 pages. It would include things like, what are the primary mechanics? What are the compulsion loops? You know, what kind of like habitual actions do I want the players to go from one thing to the next to the next? It also went into the aesthetics. I thought a lot about like, what is my color palette? What is the kind of theme of the game? So my game, I chose a Cold War theme because I thought that would be easy for me as a not a full-time designer to make things that looked like a 1980s computer screen.
Okay, so that's what it's like, 1980s? Is it set in that period?
Kind of like 70s, 80s, you know, if you can think of like a radar screen for some missile command. That was kind of the inspiration for what grew into the whole UI and user interface. And then, you know, I took the colors from that. So there's a whole page just about like what colors represent. In my game, like neon green always represents something that you should do. Whereas, and red always represents like the enemy and something you should avoid. So things like that, that subconsciously communicate to the player are best when you plan them ahead. Other things in the game design document are the level progression. One thing I really learned, I think everybody knows this, but it's really hard if you're a developer to do this. How do you teach a strategy game to somebody without telling them explicitly in words? Because when people see a pop-up, they just close it. They do not read those pop-ups. It's really frustrating as a game developer. You have to teach people how to play your game intuitively through your level design. So in your game design document, you have to break down all of your mechanics. And then you have to design a level for each mechanic to introduce it to the player so that they just learn without telling them.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the things in the game design document, how to teach the player how to play the game. And then once they get the skills to play the game and they know how everything works, where do you go from there?
Right. Interesting. Yeah, that's definitely a unique property of the mobile platform in general. Attention spans measured in seconds. If someone's playing a PC game or a console game, you have to boot up the console, you have to wait, it takes time, there's loading screens. People are used to sitting down, getting comfortable, waiting a few minutes, and that's just part of those platforms. But with mobile, it's like, I need it now. There's like instant gratification mindset. And so game developers, or at least successful ones, are thinking about and answering those questions. How can we get immediately to gratifying gameplay experiences, and how can we reduce the waiting time? Because even a loading of 10 seconds will result in a significant number of people just uninstalling the game immediately.
Right, right. Especially with free-to-play.
Was there a lot of scrutiny on the first-time experience in the game?
In the end, there was. I think when I started the game, when I started building it, I started building what would end up being the middle and end levels, like the high strategy of the game. Because as the developer, I was focused on how can I make a strategy game, you know, where people have to think really hard and make meaningful decisions and use creative solutions to win. But in the end, and after beta testing, which I think we'll talk about a little later, I spent the past year actually just focusing on the beginning of the game, which is the most important part, because that's where people decide if they're going to keep playing or not.
Right.
So from the first introduction screen to when the player hits start to going into the game and making sure all those transitions are smooth and everything looks nice, I did put a lot of thought into the beginning of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have to do, especially on mobile.
Right.
So after making a game design document, I'd say the next step is gathering your team. Who's going to help you build this game? Because it's a ton of work to build a game. And it's also interdisciplinary. And some of those disciplines aren't really related to each other. Like a programmer is not usually a designer.
Right, in terms of like creating art assets.
Yeah, and a designer, like an illustrator, is not the same as a game designer who works in like Excel to balance your game. And then, you know, music composition, all these different things. It's hard to gather a team of people. And you remember we had a game design group.
Yes.
And that group was brought together by the idea of, let's build a game.
That was a little bit like the Game Ideas subreddit, that group.
Yeah, and I don't think that paradigm works. You can't get people together and say, let's build a game. In my experience, you need a game idea. You almost need your whole design document done. And then you approach people and you show them. And they either get on board or they don't. And that's what seems to work.
It felt like in that, I mean, the subreddit works, I think, in the same way that our WeChat group works, which is that people pitch ideas which sound cool, and there's a constant stream of those. But steps beyond that have to be taken by individual actors, not by the group.
So my team isn't very big, and 95% of it is me. But I did get a musical composer, Eric, our friend, and he wrote just an awesome soundtrack. In fact, the story of getting Eric on board is pretty cool because I was developing the game at Berlin House, which is a coffee shop we hang out at, and Eric was there producing music or something. We just got to talking. I didn't know him. And he said, what are you doing? I told him about the game. I told him I needed music. And then, you know, we both got back to work. And like 20 minutes later, he said, come over here. And he put his headphones on me. He's like, how about this for your game? And he had already written like one or two songs for the game. I was like,
oh, it's brilliant.
Wow, this is pretty cool.
Yeah, I'll tell you also, I've been involved in the music scene here in Chengdu for well over a decade. I know probably as many music producers here as any expat does. I would say Eric is definitely on the short list of the best people you could collaborate with on this particular project.
Yeah, well, a week later, he came back with the whole soundtrack. You know, we had just, I had briefly gone over kind of like, yeah, maybe we could work together. And then he comes back and he's already done the whole soundtrack for the game, and it was great. And I think the soundtrack adds a lot to the game. I've had a number of the beta testers comment that they really enjoy the soundtrack. So Eric,
that's great. And he did sound effects as well?
He helped with some of the kind of UI sound effects. So all the UI stuff, the beeps and boops, they're all in key with the music, which is cool. And then the second thing I needed was an illustrator. So I actually, my girlfriend, she wanted to learn like Photoshop and stuff. So she illustrated most of the, not the UI, but like the kind of airplanes and ships. I guess you could call it the character art of the game.
Sure.
And she did it all on an iPad with a little stylus.
That's kind of neat. Unconventional. Most people would use like a Wacom tablet, but.
Well, she was just beginning. And we didn't have any of that stuff. So she would draw it on an iPad and then I would load it up into Photoshop and just fix it up. And that was my team. It was me, a music composer, and an illustrator.
Great. Well, those are the bare bones, I guess. I mean, you could have done those other things yourself. It just would have taken you more time.
We would be doing this podcast probably 2 years from now if I had to do all that other stuff.
Maybe you're right. And then you had a music producer just sort of serendipitously make an entire soundtrack for you in 1 week. So that's a good outcome there. But I would be curious to hear, you spent 2,000 hours working on this. What were the parts which you didn't see coming, which were real big challenges? I mean, certainly you must have spent a lot of that time, like a disproportionate amount of that time, on particular challenges which were really time consuming or really difficult. What were those?
Yeah, well, obviously programming is one of the big ones. I had some experience programming, but you know, programming a game is just a whole nother level. And tools like GameMaker, and also tools like, I forget what Unity has, this drag and drop tool that you're supposed to not need to code. But at the end of the day, you need to learn how to code if you're going to make a full game.
Yep.
So learning all of the basics of programming, things like variables and variable scope, learning all your conditional statements, learning the basics of object-oriented programming. You know, in a game is filled with objects. And each object has its own rules that governs how it interacts with other objects. And it's emergent. You don't know what's going to happen in a game. Unlike other software where the pathways are fixed, and it might be easy for a software developer to just write out the whole program, in a game, you have to write a series of objects and teach them how to interact with each other, and then kind of like let your hands go and watch and make sure they interact with each other. So learning programming was a big step.
What is the language of GameMaker?
GameMaker uses something called GML, GameMaker language. It looks a lot like C. It's like C with forgiveness.
Okay.
It's a forgiving form of C. Like if you forget the semicolon, your game won't crash.
Oh, wow. That is a big difference.
Yeah.
That's cool.
It's nice for somebody getting started.
A lot of really notable games have been made with GameMaker as well. I think we mentioned this previously on a podcast, but I believe Hotline Miami. There's a list of notable games which have been global bestsellers.
Do you have any favorites, GameMaker games?
Well, Hotline Miami is the first one which comes to mind. That's one of my favorite independent games of all time.
Hyper Light Drifter, pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
Art-wise.
Pretty cool. Art-wise, exactly. Art-wise seems to be what it excels at. But anyway, the point is that GameMaker is pretty accessible. It's known for being a pretty easy tool to get into, relatively speaking, compared to Unity or a lot of these more advanced, complicated, difficult platforms. But with that said, GameMaker has also been used to make some truly global blockbuster games, which people have built real businesses around.
Yeah, I'm still trying to think. Cook Serve Delicious.
Oh, yeah, that's a fun one.
GameMaker game.
We played that at CGF event.
There's a number of them. There's the GameMaker Showcase. If anybody's interested, just on Yo-Yo Games, they have the GameMaker Showcase, and they've got all the games listed. They have some pretty cool games.
Yo-Yo Games is the creator of GameMaker.
Right.
They do a lot of great sales on Steam and other places. I think I even have GameMaker in my Steam library just because it was so inexpensive at some Steam sale. So it's great that it's so accessible.
Yeah, and you know, I bought it on Steam, and for one, it tracks my hours, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I was wondering how you got the 2,000 hour figure. It's through Steam.
Right, I know exactly how many hours I spent, which is pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
Another thing, there's, what do you call it? There's achievements.
Yeah.
So I every once in a while, you'll just get an achievement in GameMaker, and sometimes it's hilarious. Like your game is crashing and you're beating your head on the keyboard. You're so mad. And then you get the achievement, ding, 100 crashes.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's a really cool tongue-in-cheek, fun little part to add. You know, I think Steam is a great distribution platform. I mean, aside from being the best platform for PC games by a light year, it's also a great model for software distribution in general. If Steam were to branch out into, you know, productivity applications like GameMaker, I think that would be really cool. Achievements are pretty neat to add. Adding one simple way to update and install apps is great. So it's good that you got GameMaker through Steam. I know you can get it off of Steam also.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to caution though is if you get it through Steam, because I had to deal with this, Steam only lets you run one thing at a time. So like you can't run GameMaker and then on your other computer be playing Rust,
right,
which was something I wanted to do. It wouldn't let me do that.
Mm, yeah, good point.
So some of the things I had to learn, juicing. I didn't know what juicing was. But as it turns out, computer programs are not naturally stimulating. They kind of, even if you program something that looks like a game, when you play it, it feels like a calculator. You know, you have to do what in the indie game community developers have called juicing, to make your game stimulating to the player. So I'll give you some examples, and when I say them, you'll probably know exactly what I'm talking about. Screen shake. Screen shake makes whatever action you did feel big, like you moved your whole computer. Chroma shift. You familiar with that, where they take...
Color shifting?
They take the RGB of a sprite and they just
sure.
move to the side.
Yep, it's like a visual color effect.
Particle effects are great. Particle effects just means you produce like hundreds of these little maybe sparks or flames, or, you know, in my game, when you blow up a ship, all the little pieces of metal just fly out.
Right.
Things like that. Another one is using math and programming for movement. So that sounds a little weird, but if you make a game where you press left and you move left, and then you stop pressing left and you just stop, that's going to feel very bland. So you have to actually go in and write some equations for acceleration and deceleration, and then like a little bit of a slide. And you add all these things that make your game feel more like a game and less like a computer program.
Sure.
When it comes to sound, let's say you have a footstep sound. So you're walking around and it's going tut-tut-tut-tut-tut-tut-tut-tut. It's pretty annoying. So you can do things like pitch variation. So every footstep is just a little bit different than the one before it. And it's just anything you can do to make your game just a little bit more stimulating. And it's almost separate from game design. These are just things that kind of like hack the human primate brain and make them say, I'm having fun right now.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I never heard of it described as juicing before. That's cool.
Yeah, I think, what is it? Like Candy Crush is a classic example of like, what, people are playing a puzzle game, but it's so stimulating. There's like these bright colors and they look like food and they burst and they go like,
pew. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All the visual effects, all the subtle effects really add up a lot to make the game feel dynamic and lifelike.
So that stuff is really important. And in my game, you know, one thing I juiced the crap out of, whenever you beat the other player, there's this explosion, but it's not just an explosion. Like the camera zooms in and the whole screen's shaking and it's exploding and there's stuff flying everywhere. And then there's a big flash and then it says victory. And that makes the player feel good. The player does that one or two times and then they kind of get hooked. Like every level, they're like, oh, I want to get to that explosion.
No kidding. That's cool. Was that a difficult part to add? I mean, aside from the mechanics of you're guiding the ship, you're guiding it towards the aircraft carrier, you're avoiding gunfire, things like that. After you get past those steps, then adding these sort of things, how much of that is time-consuming, difficult work, or is it pretty trivial and easy once you get these concepts down?
I say it takes a lot of time because you need it to look good and feel good, you know? For example, in my game, you have these ships and they shoot. And every time they shoot the gun and they hit the other ship, there's a little explosion. But it felt flat. So I had to make it so whenever you hit the other ship, the ship wobbles a little bit. And then it felt better. But then there's big ships and little ships. And if the big ship wobbles just as much as the little ship, then it feels weird. So you have to go in and you have to tweak. And you say, all right, the big ship wobbles less. But what if two gunshots hit? Then you have to incorporate two wobbles. So there's all these little things that you wouldn't think about, but they ultimately affect the feeling that the player gets. And that big explosion that I talked about earlier, I spent at least 2 weeks on that, making that look cool and feel good.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's really fascinating to hear. So once you get to the basic steps of a functional game, the next step was get your friends and family to play the game, or did you get into beta testing, or what was the next step once you've got the basics sort of down and the game is functional?
Right. Yeah. When, you know, if you go on the indie game community and you ask about indie development, everyone's going to say you need to start testing early. You need to test constantly. You need to test every step of the way. You need to listen to the feedback. You need to watch the players play the game. And I couldn't agree more. For me, the process went something like this. I developed the game. I got it to a point where I thought maybe I could give this to another developer and let him test it. So my first developer was Dan, and he was into GameMaker at the time. I think he stopped. And I sent it to him. He played the game. It was 5 levels. He beat it. And he said, well, pretty cool. It's about the level of a Flash game.
Yep.
And I was like, ooh, that hurts. But That's probably right. So
nothing wrong with the Flash game. Yeah. Actually, there's a. I just saw a YouTube clip the other day by Nakey Jakey. Have you ever seen that YouTube channel?
No.
Pretty good. Recommend it. Anyway, he made a video about why Flash games are overlooked as being significant contributors to game culture.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
In any case, Flash game, not necessarily a bad thing, especially on mobile.
So I started with Flash game and I worked a year to upgrade myself. So then like just over a year ago for my birthday party, I did like my first beta test. It's kind of the unveiling of my game. And I got all, it was kind of a safe environment, right? Because it's all my friends.
Yep.
So all my friends came and I sat and watched them play the game. Each person, I'd install the game on their phone and I'd watch them play it.
Yep.
And the very first thing that I learned was what I talked about earlier, is that nobody understood how the hell to play my game.
You learned so much through that process. I've hosted a couple beta testing events for mm-hmm. previous employers that I worked at, and I noticed the same thing. I would show them a beta version of a game and I just observe. You don't say anything. You don't give them any guidance, any idea of what they should be doing. They just do what they think they should do. And it was a frustrating process because you're watching them and you're like, no, why aren't you doing this? You should be doing it this way. But they don't know that. You know, the things which seem logical and straightforward to you are not logical and straightforward to other people because you have the context of knowing how the game should work and they don't. And that disconnect can be really damaging.
Yeah. So actually, I mean, I tried to not tell people. The first one or two testers, I didn't tell them. And they just got frustrated within 5 minutes and quit. You know, so the next couple beta testers that same day, I sat there and I explained all the mechanics and I explained the whole game, which you're not supposed to do, but I just wanted to see how a player would play if they understood the game. And then I noticed those players had a lot of fun. And that was probably the first big piece of encouragement that I got from my players, was seeing them have fun once they understood the game. So from my first closed beta, or you might call it an alpha test even, what I learned was, you need to teach the players how to play the game in a way that's fun. But once they get there, the game is fun. And I learned that. And that was probably the thing that really kept me going for the next year. That was a year ago. So I spent the whole next year taking every single thing that confused those beta testers and making it obvious in the game, either by designing a level that teaches it to you or adding some UI elements that make it very obvious on screen. So the second beta test, which has been a bit more of an open beta test, I've just been kind of broadcasting on Reddit, Facebook, our gaming group on WeChat, and just finding all kinds of testers on iOS and Android. And I've got about 50 testers. And this test, the game is supposed to be finished. It's just about all the work that I'm going to put into this game.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, the testers got it. You know, I don't have to sit there and explain it to them. I was really encouraged by some of the testers are fanatical about the game. I've got a number of testers who not only beat every single level, but they spent time to, each level has like, you can go back and play for objectives.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go through and they would beat every single objective and every single part of the game.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's encouraging.
And then they would send me like books worth of feedback. So I got into a program. It lasted about 2 or 3 weeks where every morning I wake up, check my email. All the beta testers have given me their comments and like add this or this confused me or this ship got stuck here. And then I would fix all those things and I would push an update out that evening. And then the next morning I'd wake up to a whole new set of emails. And I did that for about 3 weeks.
Wow, these are really ideal beta testers then.
They are fantastic, man. And they are a big part of the game's development. I had no idea that just random people playing my game would become so involved.
How did you find these 50 people? Some of them are friends like me and other people in the CGF group who know you personally and are helping. Is that, that's not everybody though, right?
It's kind of like friends and friends of friends. You know, the first one I did on my birthday was my friends. And this one is more just like, anyone, I shout and anyone that can hear me can be a beta tester.
Right.
It's not really closed. So some of them are on Reddit, some of them from different social media groups and just things like that.
Got it. Have you noticed any big differences in Android versus iOS deployment, because you're on both of those platforms, right?
Yeah, my iOS game works great. And I'm going to submit to the App Store on Friday because I'm just confident it's good to go.
Wow.
The Android version keeps crashing. Yep. So that's something I'm going to have to deal with. It's hard because I just don't own an Android phone. So I'm going to borrow or buy one, try to fix it.
That's a good idea. I think that's pretty important for development purposes.
Yeah. So what I think I'm going to do is this Friday, which is tomorrow, I'm going to submit for App Store publication, and I'm going to submit for the Google Play open beta, which means that anyone, anyone can download my game and play it, and it's probably going to be discounted, but because it's a beta, it's understood that the game is still in development and has some problems, and I'm going to try to iron out the whatever the bug is that's making it crash on Android through the open beta testing.
Android is a lot more difficult because you're dealing with so many different variations in hardware, resolution. Android, there's just a huge discrepancy between different devices, literally thousands of different Android devices. Whereas with iPhone, it has become much more fragmented in recent years. You're dealing with a lot of different resolutions, aspect ratios, devices, going all the way back to, I think the iPhone 6 is the oldest one, which is still updated and supported by Apple officially. But so there is more fragmentation there, but not even close to comparable to Android. You're just working with so many different devices. And unfortunately, some people will just have older Android devices, which might not be compatible with games, which have already gone through extensive testing.
Yeah, I can tell you on the back end that the developer console for both, you know, the App Store and for Google Play, the App Store is just hard to set up in the beginning. You have to do this thing with the license keys and your distribution certificates. And you have to pay $100 every year to be an Apple developer. But once you get it going, it's really nice. You kind of you push a deployment through test flight, and it just updates on everybody's phones. I have a list where I could see exactly how much people are playing and what version of my game they have installed. Meanwhile, on the Google Play Store, it was kind of easier to get started. It's $25 one-time lifetime Google developer fee, which is great. And once you upload it, you can't really see like who's playing it or how much, at least in the beta phase. On Google Play, it's actually called alpha. Beta is when it's open. In the alpha phase, you can't really see who's playing it or how much. One cool thing that you do get on the Google Play developer console is you get these crash reports. So I do get, the only reports I can see is when it crashes, I get just this whole list of code and I can try to figure out why it crashed.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's useful. So now you're getting ready to submit the game on iOS, and presumably once you get these bugs ironed out, then you'll submit it on Android as well. What does it look like as you launch this game? Are you looking at a launch date? Are you going to promote it? How do you feel about marketing the game? This is surely one of the biggest challenges which you're going to face in this whole process.
Yeah, you know, I used to work for a publishing company, a game publishing company. And prior to working for a game publishing company, I had no idea that game publishing is its own industry, separate from game development. But it really is. Just with this game, I have to develop the icon, the screenshots, the preview video, the description text, and these are just the prerequisites to get on the store in the first place. And they're not just boxes to tick. Everything from the icon to the screenshots, etc., are the determining factors on whether or not people download your game.
Crucial.
So you have to spend a lot of time making a good icon, getting good screenshots, doing a good video. And these are full-time jobs that usually are outsourced. So as an indie developer, you might think you're finished with your game and still have months of work ahead of you just developing all of your marketing materials.
Right. Not to mention getting in touch with publications, you know, YouTubers, all sorts of different influencers online to try to get eyes onto the game, get people onto the page, whether it's on the App Store or on Google Play.
Right. So the next thing you have to do after you assemble all of your publication assets for both, and I'm talking mobile here, for both the App Store and Google Play, and of course they're different. They require different things. The next thing you have to do is assemble a press kit and then maybe a list of all the influencers you're going to try to reach out to, whether they be YouTubers or Twitch streamers or blog writers and get that press kit out there and try to get in touch with them and try to get people to cover your game. Because once it's on the App Store or the Google Play Store, it's right next to like a gazillion other games.
Yep. And how many games is it that launch per day? It's something like 5,000 or something.
It's huge. It's, you know, I have a few things going for my game that I think might help me stand out, but really it's a shot in the dark. You don't know if your year of work is going to, I don't even know if I'm going to make that $1.
Right. You'll make the $1, I'm certain. But yeah, you're right. You have no clue. I mean, it's hard to call this. I mean, unless you're working with, you know, a professional publisher, like you say. I mean, if you can, like Devolver Digital, for example, it's like one of the biggest independent game developer or publishers in the world. If you have an independent game which is published by them, guaranteed to be hundreds of thousands of downloads.
Mm.
So if you work with a professional publisher, then, you know, that is an option. But I would say like a tiny, tiny fraction of independent games will have that kind of outcome.
Well, my game has a few things going for it, which make me hopeful that it will do at least a little well. One of them is the Yo-Yo Game Showcase.
Mm-hmm.
The Game Maker Showcase. I have not seen another strategy game in there. So I think my game will make a great addition to their showcase.
Yeah.
Another thing I have going for my game is that it's a single player offline RTS strategy game. Now, I know that's a niche and a lot of people are playing multiplayer games. But if you want to play a strategy game offline because you're on the airplane or you just don't want to play against other people, there's not a lot of options. Are you familiar with any?
No.
On mobile?
Nothing comes to mind.
So my game ticks a few of these kind of strange boxes. There's not a lot of other games like it.
I think there's a short list of offline strategy games, just to begin with.
Right.
But I really like those. I really like offline strategy games.
Can you name any of them?
Yeah, one I'm playing recently is called Pixel Dungeon, which was actually recommended in the CGF group. It's a fantastic game. It is, there's a paid upgrade to remove ads, but otherwise it's free.
Cool. Is that on mobile or
yep,
PC?
It's on mobile. Okay. It's on iPhone and Android. I mean, if you look on PC, there's a much larger selection of offline strategy games.
Yeah, there's one that just came out that's a little bit similar to my game, that it's a turn-based offline strategy game, which is for mobile, Into the Void.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I've heard of that.
Which is doing really well by the makers of Faster Than Light.
That's right. That's right. Oh, you mean Into the Breach.
Into the Breach. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah,
Into
yeah.
the Breach.
Into the Breach is brilliant. It's one of the best games of 2018, in my opinion. FTL, also one of the best strategy games. Yeah, these are good examples. These are offline strategy games. FTL is real-time, and Into the Breach is turn-based. Some of the best strategy games I've ever played. FTL has a great story behind it as well, developed by two guys in Beijing, China, who worked for 2K here in China. So they worked in commercial game development. They became disillusioned with corporate game development. So they quit their jobs, decided to work on an independent project, funded it on a Kickstarter successfully.
Nice.
Actually got like 5 times their requested funding amount. Made wow. FTL, and it turned into a smash hit, which is not that common. You know, a lot of Kickstarter projects, which are based around games, meet their funding goals, but then kind of peter out or just don't become that good or that successful. FTL, smashing success, led to the creation of their company, and they've achieved even, you know, more with their follow-up game, Into the Breach.
Yeah, I haven't played it yet, but Into the Breach looks really cool.
Get it on your Switch.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, but for sure, that's a rare example. I mean, that's a very, very special case.
Hmm.
So, but that's great to hear. I'm looking forward to checking out the game as it launches fully and seeing kind of what the post-launch experience is like. How do you feel about monetization of your game? Are you looking at ads or in-app purchases or an upfront cost?
I'm just going to stick to my principles and charge a modest price for the game. I hate in-app purchases. I know that they generate the most revenue, but I'm going to sell my game for $3. It's pretty cheap. You buy the game, it takes about 5 to 6 hours to beat it in easy mode. So I think you get your money's worth. Once you beat easy mode, you unlock hard mode. So you could say altogether, you get 10 hours of gameplay for $3.
That's a ton of content. That's a lot of content for a mobile game. I think the vast majority of mobile games, I feel like after I've played them for an hour, I'm kind of done with them.
Right. Right. Yeah. So
So there's going to be no ads. There's going to be no in-app purchases.
None of that.
You know, to have no in-app purchases is a really attractive feature. I'll say this. I mean, when we're talking about publishing a game and we just talked about creating the app icon, creating the description, the screenshots, the videos, all this stuff creates a general impression of how attractive the game is going to be to a prospective player. One of the big things which I look for is that it does not include in-app purchases. And it's actually pretty rare that I see that. It's pretty rare that you see a game which is for sale for an upfront cost, which does not include even a single in-app purchase. It's not that common. But when that is the case, I find that really satisfying. That really will push me to even buy a game upfront, just because I want to feel like I'm getting everything that's available with this purchase and nothing is being held back.
Cool. Yeah, I do think some indie games are going that route, you know, going upstream and just selling their game for one price, one app purchase.
You know, I think a lot of the illusions around in-app purchases are starting to fall away just a little bit. And I think that's why we're starting to see that change. I think one of the dreams has been that, you know, if you sell your game and put in-app purchases in it, just a stream of money will follow and everything will just kind of work out. But we've been far, far along this road enough for many developers to see that, well, it might not work out that way, because there have also been a lot of cases of failure of games which have pursued that monetization strategy. And now I think a lot of game developers accurately see that a more sustainable, practical way to deal with this problem is just to sell the game for a small upfront fee like you're doing.
So before we wrap up, let me just put a little plug in here. My game is called Carrier Commander: War at Sea. It's available on iOS and Google Play soon. It is an indie strategy game. It is an offline naval strategy game set in a Cold War era. The game features head-to-head battles between carrier strike groups. It's kind of a hybrid of turn-based, where you're moving your ships, and live action, where you draw the flight path and then watch the battle happen for 5 seconds, and then you get your turn again. Another unique feature that I kind of borrowed from XCOM is something called the Arms Race, which also comes from the Cold War. And basically, your tech tree is a competitive tech tree. So you versus your opponents, and it lasts the whole game. So rather than like a lot of StarCraft kind of strategy games where you climb a tech tree within one round, and then the next round you start over, in this game, you have this kind of arms race where you're trying to out-research your opponent and get the best weapons by the end of the game so you can win the battles.
Nice. I have two questions before we wrap this up.
Yes, sir.
One is, did you ever think to incorporate a multiplayer functionality in the game, like two carrier groups against each other?
Well, you know, that would be amazing. I would love to have done that, but that is just another level of development. I think Carrier Commander 2. If I sell 1 million copies of Carrier Commander, Carrier Commander 2 will definitely have multiplayer, 100%.
Maybe you could patch it in.
Yeah, or maybe if the game is doing well and I get a little revenue, what I would probably do is hire, you know, like a network kind of programmer guy to program that for me.
You could do an in-app purchase.
Yeah, or do that.
Or if you don't want to do that, you could unlock a multiplayer mode. Anyway, sure. It seems like a game which is conducive to multiplayer gameplay.
Right, yeah. And if anybody wants... Oh, did you have a second question?
Yeah, my second question is, did it ever occur to you to set this in the South China Sea in a modern setting?
Yes, actually, there are some regulations in the App Store in particular about avoiding politically sensitive issues. But I did try to kind of tread that line. There's a couple different enemy countries in the game. One of them is a communist country that builds militarized islands in the sea.
Yeah, because when I play the game, I feel like, because in headlines right now is South China Sea, like naval confrontation, like conflict between the United States and Western countries and China. And that's one of the top, you know, global news stories, which has been happening over the last year and a half, 2 years. And it seems like a naval game between aircraft carriers is, I mean, the most easy to connect, you know, real world thing here is the South China Sea conflict.
Right. Yeah. So that's why I included militarized islands. Another kind of newsworthy feature I put into the game was it's set during a time of climate change where the oceans are rising and Pacific Island nations are losing their homeland.
Mm-hmm.
So in the game, you are a commander of this confederation of all the Pacific Island nations who, let's just say you'd be the Philippines, and you're trying to fight for some land against this authoritarian communist regime who is building islands and claiming parts of the sea.
Right.
But of course, there's no real countries in the game.
Sure.
They're all made up.
I see. That's kind of funny. Okay. Well, that's one way you can navigate that. Great. Well, thank you for joining me on the podcast. It was really interesting to hear about your journey publishing this game. I wish you luck in launching the game, and hopefully we'll get that multiplayer functionality one day.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That would be great.
Hey, I have one more plug. My blog is fromgametobrain.blogspot.com. So if you'd like to follow the release of the game or just get in touch with me about your game or whatever, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.